Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Hello and welcome to Shatbaggily, an old Lincolnshire adjective to describe absolutely anything loose and disorderly, which sums up this Lincolnshire lass quite nicely. My name is Katie Johnson, and in a moment you'll have a recipe for the fabulous icky sticky toffee pudding, and also hearing from a contestant from Series 2 of The Great British Bake Off, who has just released her very first cookbook. First though, because we're on Series 2, Episode 8, here are a few things with the same number. English kings named Henry and also Edward. Ounces in weight of a professional boxing glove and the largest litter of cheetahs born in captivity. Happened in November 2017 at the St. Louis Zoo River's Edge Cheetah Breeding Centre in Missouri. Usually a litter is 3 to 4 cubs, but mum Bingwa produced 3 males and 5 females with dad Jason. Not really a name I would associate with a cheetah, but there you go. So I hope you've had a good week. Chatting to a pal of mine, she received a call from a company wanting to know if she would like an emergency response watch in case of a fall or a fire, etc. So when she said, how old do you think I am? He said, it's for anyone over 50. And, you know, he even went on to ask a question. Now, I would have thought all fellas, starting as soon as they come out the womb, they are programmed, they're taught not to ask a lady their age. But no, what does this chap do? He says, may I ask you how old you are? I think perhaps I would have told him where he could put his watch and then he'd quickly find out what an emergency was. Anyway, time for my first guest. And it was lovely to bump into Justine Owens from the Pudding Shop at a recent food festival. I have known Justine, along with her dad Don and mum Dorothy, who we sadly lost last year, I've known her for many years. I have to say, they make the most delicious steamed puddings. So with that in mind, wasn't sure if Justine would share a recipe with us, but she kindly has. Their icky, sticky toffee pudding. However, a few adjustments needed, bearing in mind the size of ingredients they normally deal with.
We've worked it back and back and back and back, and now we've got a recipe that will serve about 8 little puddings,
right.
Or you can make maybe 2 big family puddings.
We do appreciate this. It's very kind of you. This one, I'm guessing, is a good seller of yours.
Always a good seller. And the one thing about this icky sticky toffee is that we don't put dates or raisins in it.
Ah.
So this divides the nation a little bit. Because people will say, no raisins, well, that's dreadful. Or no raisins, oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So this is our steamed pudding. That's a take on a icky sticky toffee pudding.
So is this because you or one of the members of the family don't do raisins and dates in a sticky toffee pudding?
Yes, absolutely.
So for purely personal and selfish reasons, this is why you do this one.
They don't belong in there. They do not belong in there. So yes, that's why we do it. Solely selfish.
Oh, bless you. Right, go on then. Take us through your recipe, because you kindly take the trouble to even write it down.
That's for my memory, because I don't do these little volumes. It feels tiny. So first of all, you'd make your sticky toffee sauce, and it's quite a basic creamy toffee sauce. So you will take 75 grams of soft dark brown sugar, pop it in a pan with 600 mils of double cream, and you want to get this to the boil, but keep stirring it so you don't burn the sugar doesn't burn. And into that, add a big heaped tablespoon of black treacle.
Okay.
So you need to bring this to the boil, and it'll take maybe 10 minutes, and just let it simmer until the sauce finally thickens out. Give it 10 minutes. It may need a couple more, but once it's thick and sort of doesn't drip right off the back of a spoon, but dollops off the back of a spoon, then you've got your sticky toffee sauce. So that's really simple.
It's a technical term, dollop, isn't it?
We like dollop.
Yeah.
We use dollop a lot.
So that's what you do first, you source?
Do your source first, and then your source can be sitting and cooling on the side. You need it cool, really, before you can use it. So get your source done, and that's out of the way.
Right.
And then onto your steam sponge. So it's pretty much a basic steam sponge mixture that you can adapt, and we adapt for different recipes. So for this recipe, for making maybe 8 little ones, first of all, you'll take 85 grams of dark brown sugar, 250 grams of butter, and cream that like you would a cake. Once that's really creamy, add 250 grams of self-raising flour and 4 eggs. And you can pretty much put this all in together, all in your mixer or your bowl, or you're going to beat it by hand, and give it a good old beat. Make sure it has a really, really good whisk, and that will make the mixture creamy, and this will help with the rising of the steam pudding. When you've got your mixture, you get either your 8 little pudding basins, so you're probably looking for about a half pint sized pudding basin if you're doing little ones, or a 1 pint if you're going to do bigger puddings.
Okay.
Grease them around. So we've got our steam sponge mixture in one bowl, and we've got our icky sticky toffee sauce in another bowl. You've got your 8 little pudding basins that have been greased. Share the toffee sauce out between the 8 pudding basins, so pop that in first, and then dollop, that good old word again, dollop the mixture again, share it evenly between the 8 pudding basins, and dollop that on top. You need to cover them with either tin foil or greaseproof paper, whatever you've got at hand, but don't put a firm lid on them, so just greaseproof or tin foil, and just tie it round with a little bit of string or ribbon or anything that you've got at hand, just to keep it firm, but a little bit of breathing space, so your pudding, when it goes into your steamer, has got space to rise.
And they go on steam for how many hours to let your kitchen all get droplets on the inside of your window?
Well, not so bad with the steam pudding. So you'll steam that for about an hour and 10 minutes. Christmas puddings, that's another story, and they are many hours. Once those are steamed, bring them out. Take them out really carefully of the steamer. Steam burns are the worst, so really, really do be careful where you're using steam. Take them out of the steamer and just pop them on the side to cool for just 10 minutes, just to get the main amount of the heat out. Remove the cover, turn the little basin upside down, take the lid off, and you have your pudding with your toffee sauce.
And another one to divide the nation. I'm custard. What are you?
Oh, I'm cream every day. Or ice cream. But if you're making a spotted dick, then there is only custard. You can only talk.
And I'm right in thinking that the pudding is calorie-free. Is that right, Justin?
Absolutely. You'll hear on the recipe, we haven't actually put any calories in those pots.
Well, they do say life is short. Eat dessert first. Thank you, Justin, from the Pudding Shop. And I'll pop the recipe on Shat Bagley's Facebook and Instagram pages with the details of their website too. And your thoughts on no dates and raisins. Interesting. Had a nosy and sticky toffee pudding was invented back in the 1940s, but its origins famously disputed, with various pubs in the UK claiming to have created it. What I can tell you is that next year, on January the 24th, it will be International Sticky Toffee Pudding Day. Staying with vintage recipes, I came across author Adele Davis and her title Let's Cook It Right, first published in 1963. If you tune in regularly to Shat Bagley, flipping heck, you deserve a medal. You will know I love an index, and it's what drew me to this book. For instance, you'll love this, Get Acquainted with Fish. Hello. What else have I found here? Oh yeah, Dress Up Your Meats. Oh, I've got visions of little bow ties and socks. And probably my favourite, milk cannot be overemphasised. If that's not a car sticker, it should be. Now, my next guest is someone I came across whilst I was booking guests for this September's Ludlow Food Festival. Avashi Rowe, a former Bake Off contestant from Series 2, now a freelance food writer, has just published her first book featuring 100% vegetarian and vegan snacks, Gujarati style. It's called Biting, Biting. That's an interesting name for a book.
The title is the way that my family talk about snacks. I thought it was just a Gujarati thing, but I did some research on Instagram and it turns out that it is just my family that say biting, biting. A lot of Gujaratis will say biting, but my family will say biting, biting, or they'll sometimes say biting. So yeah, it just means snacking, really. Yeah. Let's do some biting, biting.
Okay. Some good reviews I've seen already.
I hope so. Yeah, it's been a long time coming that the idea for a book has been in my head for a while. And originally this was a chapter in a bigger Gujarati kind of cookbook. But when I was chatting to Kitchen Press, who's the publisher, we thought this would make actually a really nice little bite-sized book. So there we are.
You like to do things, because when you went on Bake Off, you were 40 and you wanted to do 40 things.
40 new things.
It could have been anything, those 40 things. Going on a television programme is one I perhaps wouldn't have put on my list.
I've done TV before, so I lived in Japan for about 4 years. Straight after university, I went out there to teach, and my company was doing a series of adverts and they wanted some of the teachers to kind of be involved in them. So I did Japanese TV, which was hilarious. It was so much fun because I didn't understand anything that was going on. I literally just kind of got moved somewhere and they said, smile now. And I'm like, okay. And I smiled. So it was just really fun. And when I was making the list, I was a little bit drunk, had quite a lot to drink. And it was kind of after my 40th birthday, and 52 now, so that seems like an awful long time ago. Well, yeah, we'd had a bit to drink, and I said to my husband, well, I'm not going to get boring. You know, all these middle-aged people, they kind of don't do anything. I don't want to be one of those people. I want to carry on doing loads of things. So let's make a list of things, and then we'll definitely do them. Because for me, I'm a list person. If it's on a list, get done.
Yeah,
it went on there. It was really totally random. I think it was almost the following day I was Googling a bread recipe and I came across Hollywood's website and he had an advert on there around applying for the Bake Off. And I was like, oh, there we go. There's TV. Let's apply for that. And that was that. I filled in the form, sent it off. On the Monday, I got a call from the production company and I was on the phone for like, oh God, must have been hours, 2 hours maybe, just going through the form, chatting to this lovely producer lady. I think it was Laura was her name. And at the end of the chat, she invited me for my first interview, which was on Wednesday. Mm. So I went along for the first kind of audition, made a sweet thing, made a savoury thing. And then they invite me back for Friday. And that was that really. So my process was actually very, very quick. Holly, who was my year, I think hers was quite long, actually, over months and months and months. So for me, it was quite quick. I didn't really have time to think about it. I think if I'd had time to think about it, I might have been a bit more nervous and a bit more cautious. Mm. But it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. I'll come. And that was that, really.
Had you seen the first series? Because that was really quite scary, going all around the country and filming. Whereas yours was the first one in the tent, wasn't it?
Yes, but it was in a public park. It was hilarious because you're filming and then there's all these people kind of around the sides, kind of like looking in and watching. And I think it was either the series After Hours or maybe the one after where they hired, you know, the hotel and they did it in the private grounds. It was all very quiet and peaceful. But no, we didn't have any of that. We stayed in some dodgy travelodgy place in Ilford and were bused to Ilford Park every day. And, you're not allowed to go home. So you had to stay in a hotel. And I kept saying to the producers, yeah, but I only live like 20 minutes down the road. Can I just go home? And no, you have to stay here. So, yeah, very, very different. It's great to see the way it's evolved. I mean, it's such a big thing now. It's huge, isn't it?
So we had Miranda Grawl Brown, who was a finalist.
Oh, I love Miranda.
The first year.
Yeah.
And she was saying they even had to queue for the toilets, which we know it's all done by time at the Bake Off. So if you've got, I don't know, an hour and a half to do something, out of that hour and a half, you've got to go to the toilet. If you've got a queue, I'm guessing you had as well then, did you?
No, it wasn't so bad, to be honest. I don't remember. We were quite close to the loo. So the only thing I do remember is being mic'd up in the loo. So it was a bit of a navigation exercise to go do your business with all of the wires and everything. That took some getting used to.
Do you still follow it as a matter of interest?
I do. I kind of dip in and out of it now, to be honest. I think that since it moved to different presenters and a different channel, less so, because, you know, loved Mel and Sue. They were just absolutely incredible hosts, and I don't think any of us could have gone through without Mel and Sue. They were just there every time you needed a cuddle or a hug or just some words of encouragement. So yeah, I do dip in and dip out, and I think I must admit the quality has gone right up, hasn't it? Some of the things that they produce now, it's like, my goodness, I could never have done that.
I'm going to pluck you then, before we move on to what we're going to chat about, before we leave Bake Off.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pluck you out of your series, so series two, and I'm going to pop you into another series of your choice. Which one would it be?
Oh, well, that's really hard. Probably the one with James Hillary. Because I chat to him quite a bit. He also works in the same area of London as I do. So I've met him for coffee a couple of times. But yeah, probably the one with James, because James is so fun. And there's a couple of people in that series that were quite fun. I don't know. That's a really hard question. Or maybe the first one, because then I could go and hang out with Miranda.
And Q.
Yeah, and Q in the loo and have a natter while we queue.
Okay, granted. I'll sort that out. Funny you mentioned James. James was a guest a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and I didn't realise there was a link between you either.
It was really random, actually, because I think I was I follow him on Instagram because he was doing loads of sourdough stuff for a while, so I started following him. And he posted some pictures of a place where he works, and I was like, oh, my God, that's round the corner from me. Shall we meet for coffee? And we did, and we had a lovely natter.
Oh, wow, funny. Interesting, I was looking at some of the information about you, as we've never met, but it says here, Bake Off contestant, obviously, food writer, yes, we know, Guild of Food Writers member, a mezcal enthusiast. What's that?
Yeah.
What's that?
Mezcal is an alcoholic drink from Mexico, and you've got tequila and you've got mezcal. When we were traveling to Mexico, we kind of had to make a decision as to whether to go for tequila or for mezcal. And I'd never really tried mezcal before. I love tequila. I love margaritas. That's kind of like tequila and tonic, and margaritas are my favorite drinks. And tequila is kind of this way, and mezcal is this way towards Oaxaca, and tequila is kind of more towards Guadalajara. We had to kind of make a decision as to which one we were going to go. And so neither of us, my husband and I, had tried mezcal, but I was absolutely fascinated by the process, because what they do is like they smoke it to get the smoky kind of flavor. So it's kind of made in a similar way to tequila, but with smoke. So you get that smoky kind of flavor. And when we were in Oaxaca, we did this amazing tour out to see this guy who he'd bought back land that used to grow these agaves, huge agaves, different varieties of them. And, you know, it was his land for as far as I could see. But it had been brought by a commercial US production company, and they'd kind of had a go for a couple of years. And then basically that was that. They, you know, had enough and decided to pack up. So this beautiful land, they'd kind of decimated it completely. And when we went to visit, it was just amazing, because this chap had been trying to revive all of the different varieties of agave that exist in the area. Wow. And cultivating them so that, you know, they could maintain those traditions going forward. And oh my God, we tried so many different types of mezcals. And it turned out my husband absolutely hated it, didn't like that kind of smokiness, but I love it. So now if there is a mezcalita on the menu instead of a margarita, then I would rather go for that.
Oh, gee, I'd never ever heard of it. So I've learned something really today. Yeah.
Oh yeah, give it a go. It's okay. Lovely. And they have it in Mexico, they have it like in a little shot glass, and you just sip it, a bit like whiskey. So you can put ice in it and just sip it, or just sip it neat. And it's fascinating, because it comes in clear, like water, or you can get kind of really whiskey coloured varieties. And then we did this other kind of trip, which was out to visit a lady who uses plants to naturally dye fabric and wool. And we did a workshop with her, and over lunchtime, her husband kind of beckoned and said, you know, come over here. And he took us to this enormous mezcal collection, and it had all manner of insects and plants kind of infused in all of these bottles. We got really drunk again. So yeah, definitely have a try. There's loads of varieties available over here now, which is great to see.
There's me sitting here. I feel a bit missed out with my cup of tea, but there we go. I'll pretend. Hang on. Definitely not anything exciting in that cup of tea other than a cup of tea. So you do recipe development as well, which is obviously a big thing with your book anyway, although those would have been your recipes handed down, would they?
They're handed down but evolved, I guess. So my mum taught me to cook. I was about 8 years old. Her dad was not very well back in Tanzania, where I was born in Tanzania. Mum was born in Tanzania. My dad travelled to Tanzania when he was about 5 years old. And with all of the kind of Idi Amin stuff that was happening, my dad decided that he wanted to leave. But my grandparents and pretty much most of my mum's family are back in Tanzania still now, actually. So anyway, her dad was ill. I was about 8 years old. And at that time, there weren't that many Indian restaurants, certainly not Gujarati restaurants, you know, near where we lived in Hanwell. And my dad is your Indian equivalent of meat and two veg. He'll have his shak or his kind of vegetable curry, his dal, his rice, his two rotlis, chapatis, and that's that. That's kind of my dad every day. Doesn't snack. He'll have his kind of slurpy tea for breakfast, maybe with some puri. But yeah, he's very particular. So she's like, right, you're going to have to cook for him. And so she taught me the basics, rice, you know, boiling rice, which is not that easy for an 8 year old. There's a whole process of washing it so it doesn't become starchy, la la la. So she taught me that, and I did that for about a week before she went, until she was happy that it was good. And then she taught me how to make shak. So instead of curry, we say shak. And shak can be dry shak, it can be shak with a sauce, it can be stuffed like aubergines or potatoes that have got a stuffing or a filling. And she taught me the very basic dry potato shak, which is in the book. It's not that difficult to make. I'd say it's, you know, Gujarati food is probably one of the simpler Indian foods to cook, because we don't use that many spices. Our dishes are vegetarian in the main, and so the spicing is quite light. I got my little masala tin, and she gave me a tour of what each of those things were. And she was like, this is all you will ever need. You don't need anything else that's in that cupboard. You just need the stuff that's in this tin. So you need to know it really well. And then she taught me potato shak, which is just, you know, chopped up potatoes with mustard seeds, cumin seeds, turmeric chili, and salt. That's it. And coriander, cumin powder. And then she said, okay, well, now you can add peas, and now you can add green beans, and now you can add spinach. And she kind of taught me these different combinations. Yeah. So that's really kind of how I learned to cook. And, you know, me and my dad muddled through for the 3-4 weeks that she was away. And then I didn't really cook. You know, she came back, and I don't remember cooking. I remember helping, but I don't remember cooking. So cooking came after O-levels. Everyone that I knew was going off to Greece or going backpacking or interrailing, as was popular at the time. And I wasn't allowed to go. I had to stay at home and learn to cook, because I had to be a good wife one day, and no mother-in-law was going to accept me into her house unless I was an excellent cook. So I hated her, absolutely hated my mother for making me learn how to cook when all of my friends had gone traveling and doing exciting things. So she taught me how to cook a different thing every single day. After that, really, it became the norm. So I had to cook, you know, came home from school after when I was doing A-levels, and she might have chopped the vegetables that needed cooking in the morning and made the chapati dough maybe and soaked the rice. But then I had to kind of finish that off. She didn't get home from her shift until probably about 7-8 o'clock. So, yeah, it was an everyday thing from the age of about 12.
Have you forgiven your mum now?
Yes and no. I think I realised how valuable that education was when I went to uni, because, you know, I went to uni and I think for months I didn't want to eat any Indian food, because we never went out for anything. You know, we didn't have any money, so we never went out for even pizza. So all food was alien to me if it wasn't Indian food. So for months and months, I didn't eat any Indian food. I didn't want to. And then, you know, I kind of started to miss the flavour. I started to miss the heat. And so I remember going to this little tiny little shop in Germany when I was living in Cologne. And I'd gone to the Indian restaurant and I'd begged them to give me some spices, the local Indian restaurant. I begged them to give me the spices. I didn't know what the spices were called in German. And so we'd had this kind of like sign language-y conversation because they didn't know how to speak Gujarati. I wasn't really very good at Hindi. And so just like point and do. And they very, very kindly gave me some spices and wrote down the names in German. So then I went and bought them. And, you know, cooked for myself. And that's really where I started to get homesick. And it's interesting because you go from being this kind of person who doesn't really know anybody, and then you start cooking Indian food and everybody wants to be your friend. Because it's like, oh, she's cooking again. What's she cooking? And then all kind of run into the kitchen. So that's really when I started to appreciate my mum and what she taught me. I think the thing that I didn't appreciate was the faff and, you know, the processes, some of the ways that my mum does things. And I reflect on that now, and particularly when I was writing the book, it's like, oh my God, there has to be a simpler way of doing this. And so I just practiced and practiced and practiced. And for a while, I stopped cooking Indian food because it was such a faff and it was such a process that she taught me because I had my kids. I was working full time. I didn't have time to kind of make things the way that she had taught me. So over the years, the way that I cook Gujarati food has really changed. Because I try and speed things up. I try and kind of simplify it so that there's less utensils and bowls and things being used and you know, shorter time frames and modern cooking equipment.
Mm. But look at you, if it hadn't been for Mum, you wouldn't have had all these opportunities, I guess, because you have been on TV, not just in Japan, but back in the UK, and you're called upon. And this book's going to only make your profile higher, surely.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think this is the thing. I think it's the same for any child of immigrants. You know, no matter what relationship you have with your parents, no matter how resentful of you are of the things that they didn't allow you to do when you were younger and the cultures that they enforced upon you somewhat, you know, regardless of all of that, at the end of the day, they had the gumption to pack up from a home and move their entire life. And, you know, when I was talking to my dad, when I was writing the introduction to the book, which I wrote last, and I was talking to my dad and I was trying to explain to him what I was writing, and he just couldn't, it wasn't getting through to him. So I went to the library and I got out all these books. And I said, look, Dad, this is what people write. You know, they write about their story and how they came to be here. And so, you know, I want to know my story. I've never asked you before. How did you come to be in Tanzania and how come Mum's dad ended up in Tanzania? Like, what are all the stories? And my dad's not a good storyteller. He's very quiet and shy and, you know, he's not a good conversationalist. So a lot of this was very hard to extract from him. Mm. What my dad is good at is keeping paperwork. And he has four briefcases in his house, which are just full of all of the old paperwork. So I found my grandfather's document from the British where, you know, he's got all of his digits fingerprinted, verifying that he is now a British subject. Huh. I found, you know, the passport that we arrived on stamped 5th of April, 1976, when we first arrived in this country. I knew it was April, but I didn't know it was the 5th of April, you know, looking through all these documents together, family trees and piecing together the journey, speaking to other members of the family, like my mum's brother, who's in the book. Actually, you can see him with a bottle of Tusker in the book. Almost always has a bottle of Tusker in his hand. And he is a masterful storyteller, very much like my mum's side of the family. They're very jovial, conversational, whereas my dad's side of the family have, you know, historically always been quite strict. Talking to my mum's brother actually was really the turning point for me. It's like, oh my God, there's all these stories. How am I going to get them in the book? Mm. And some of them I remembered, some of them I didn't remember, because he said to me, do you remember how you learned to walk? I was like, uncle, of course I don't remember how I learned to walk. How did I learn to walk then? And he reenacted it for me. It was hilarious. He reenacted it for me in this tiny little house in Leicester. And he said, you know, your dad used to have friends from the bank come around in the evenings. And, you know, you'd be drinking like these, that they'd be drinking beer. And your mum would give you this tray and you'd have to take it to your dad, and then your dad would tell you to take it to another person, and then to another person, and so you'd toddle along between all of these people in your nappy. And I was like, okay, that's really quite embarrassing. But, you know, that's apparently how they encouraged me to walk, was to go from one person to another person. And, of course, when I got to the person, I always got a treat. You know, they'd give me a lollipop or a sweet or, yeah, you know, something, or a book sometimes I used to get. So that's how I learned to practice my walking.
So are there all those stories? You couldn't have got them all in, but a lot of those stories mingled in with the recipes then, or is this the next thing you're working on? Because it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so there are a lot of stories mingled in to the book. The introduction is kind of the journey of how I came to be here, I suppose, today. And there are other stories mingled in, because the recipes that are in the book are recipes that are dear to me for whatever reason. And some of them are really simple recipes. And when I was writing the book, and I remember asking Emily, yeah, this isn't really a recipe. Are you sure you want me to put it in? And sometimes a recipe that isn't a recipe it becomes a recipe to somebody else. So, you know, there are lots of stories in the book, but I was talking to a friend of mine, Sumaya Usmani, who you might know. She's released a book recently called Andaz, which is her third book, I think, and it's very much a memoir with recipes. And one of my favorite books is Anna Conte's book, which is, you know, a memoir with recipes. And as I've gone through this process, so many people have said to me, you need to write this down. You need to write down your life story, because it's really interesting. You've come from there to here, and then you went traveling there, and then you lived in Japan, and there's all of that kind of stuff. And so I think it might be something that I do one day. Yes. I was looking through all of my old albums. I'm very proud of myself now, actually, that I took the time to capture photographs, keep tickets and newspaper articles and things like that since university. So I was looking through all of those and I was like, God, I've forgotten this. So yeah, there is a big part of me that wants to write this down. But there's also a part of me that goes, well, who's going to read this? I mean, it's interesting to me, but really, is this like a book worthy? So I don't know. I think I'll probably need to explore that with an agent or a publisher.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. It's whatever happens, whoever reads it, be it now or in so many years' time, it's important. So, no, I think you should do it. Really looking forward to welcome you to Ludlow Food Festival in September.
Thank you.
Wait to meet you properly.
And I meant to say to you, I loved the name of your podcast. I was looking into the name, and I was kind of like listening into a couple of them. And I love the name because I love languages. I did languages at university. And I meant to say to you, what an absolutely brilliant name. And it's completely, completely one of those words that just feels so very English. But I need to hunt down the Gujarati equivalent of it, because I'm sure that we must have one.
And I can't wait to hear what it is. Lovely lady. Thank you ever so much to Avashi Rowe. And her book, Biting Biting, is available now. And she will be at Ludlow Food Festival in Shropshire on Sunday, the 10th of September. Glyn and I have a little time off now, so I've made him a list of things that need doing around the house. Oh, he loves it when I do that. And I was even able to go and chat with my doctor about going on HRT, although I was a little stumped when he asked me what I thought it could do for me. I'd have thought and answered, and it turns out, no, it won't help me play the piano. Not on it yet, but here's hoping. Thank you for getting in touch as always. Be on Facebook, Instagram or email podcast@theshatbagley.co.uk. Good to know you enjoyed the interview with Dahe last week. Wasn't she incredible? And also the banana vinegar certainly got you talking. Hopefully going to put a recipe for that on as well, thanks to Steve, aka The Hungry Guy. And thank you to Brendan, who kindly left a review on Facebook. If you feel an urge to leave one too, please don't fight it. It's the Trooping of the Colour on Saturday, the King's official birthday. Good luck to all involved, especially in the heat we've had of late. At least three of the troops fainted during the rehearsal, and that's without the menopause. So that's it for another week. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. Right then, milk cannot be overemphasised. I think we're going to need a bigger sticker.